This episode of the Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymously and without oversight. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/paranormal and use the coupon code PARA. That's proxpn.com/paranormal and use the coupon code PARA. Thanks, ProXPN.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. You know, over the last almost, 8 years of doing this show, there have been maybe half a dozen guests who have really distinguished themselves, have been on multiple times, and are always a home run. I'm talking about the Brad Steigers of the world, the Rosemary Ellen Guileys of the world, the Marie D. Joneses of the world, the Brad Steigers of the world. And I apologize if I missed other people in that category, but certainly tonight we have one of those really elite guests with us tonight, and I'm talking about Nick Redfern. And this is a great book. It's called Monster Files, A Look Inside Government Secrets and Classified Documents on Bizarre Creatures and Extraordinary Animals. So it's kind of a melange and a mashup of cryptozoology and conspiracy theory. Here's a little bit about Nick before we get started. He works as a full-time author, a lecturer, and journalist. He writes about a wide range of unsolved mysteries, including Bigfoot, UFOs, the Loch Ness Monster, alien encounters, and government conspiracies. He writes for UFO magazine Fate and Fortean Times. His previous books include Keep Out, The Real Men in Black, The NASA Conspiracies, Contactees, and Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. Now, he's an extremely popular media guest, and he's appeared on numerous television programs, including VH1's The Legend Hunters, BBC's Out of This World, History Channel's Ancient Aliens, Monster Quest, America's Book of Secrets, and UFO Hunters, National Geographic Channel's The Truth About UFOs and Paranatural, Countdown with Keith Olbermann, and Sci-Fi Channel's Proof Positive. Nick, I'm so glad you have some time, and I know you've been on Coast to Coast many times as well, so I'm glad you still have some time to talk to us once in a while.
Well, I'm always pleased to be on the show, Jim.
Well, it's always great to have you, and welcome aboard. So what gave you this idea to kind of do this mashup of cryptozoology and conspiracy theory? What got the wheels to turning?
Well, basically, it was the fact that I've written over the years probably about 8 or 9 books on various aspects of cryptozoology.
Right.
And, you know, when you work as a writer and you get in stories, you do a lot of interviews and chase down a lot of leads. And probably, you know, 3 or 4 times a year over the past sort of 10, 15 years, I would come across snippets of stories of a cryptozoological nature, but where there was kind of like a government tie-in, but it was just snippets of stories. And then over the years, I began to realize, well, there's a lot of snippets here, you know, so why not follow them all down? Why not chase them down? So that's what I spent probably the last 18 months doing to 2 years, and then the last sort of 6 months leading up to now, just writing the book. So it's a case of digging out all these old bits of information I got here and there and going back to the witnesses or filing Freedom of Information Act requests to get previously classified files officially and legally declassified, etc. And so that was what it basically came down to. It was a realization that what started as a few snippets had grown. And if I was to develop them, you know, I could see that there's a huge picture coming together of how and why government and military agencies all around the world have taken a deep interest in weird creatures.
And the thing that gets me about this is, I mean, some people are out there, and especially Bigfoot, for example, people thought, it's a cartoon, it's a joke, it's not real. But world governments, not just the U.S. government, but governments all around the world have taken a real interest in this stuff, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it goes back sort of almost 2 centuries, the official investigations. And it's interesting how they often parallel what's going on elsewhere. You know, for example, where there have been investigations in the U.S. by the military of lake monsters, and the same thing's gone on in the U.K. So, you know, we get this situation where similar creatures seem to attract official attention. And, you know, when you realize you're actually looking at official files as well, in some cases with these documented stories, it really sort of opens your eyes to the way in which, you know, these investigations have gone on for a very long time.
Right off the bat in the book, you make a point of saying that in some cases, this goes to the very highest levels, and you can't go much higher than the President of the United States, and that great outdoorsman, Teddy Roosevelt. He had his own experience regarding Bigfoot, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, President Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, he was an avid outdoorsman and hunter, and very skilled and expert in, you know, recognizing animals, etc. And he traveled the world, not just the U.S., went on a number of overseas major investigations. And as he said, you know, he doesn't get much higher than the office of the president. And the story, basically, was one that so impressed Roosevelt. He actually wrote about it himself in one of his books. And it came from a hunter named Bowman, who was somebody who spent a lot of time with friends and colleagues out hunting in the Pacific Northwest woods, like Washington State, Oregon, that sort of area. And he was a very skilled hunter and spent a lot of time tracking and living out in the woods, you know, making makeshift dens and camps, that kind of thing. And he related to the president how he'd been involved in this weird affair just a few years earlier, when there were a number of very savage killings of people out in the Pacific Northwest woods. And whatever killed the people, you know, it seemed to exhibit a lot of savagery, a lot of violent activity. But what was weird is that the footprints, or paw prints, however you want to describe them, suggested the creature was bipedal, you know, walked on two legs rather than a four-legged animal, like, you know, a mountain lion will attack people, but it clearly wasn't that. And he had very large prints. Now, the first thought was, back in the 1800s, you know, nobody was really talking about Bigfoot then, although there were reports of so-called wild men that would pop up now and again in the newspapers. But the prints were very large, and as I said, the first thought was, well, it's got to be a bear. But, you know, bears can stand on their hind legs, and they will sort of make steps on their hind legs, but they certainly don't walk on their hind legs exclusively, and certainly don't run or dash about killing people just on their hind legs. But all these tracks were clearly just the same two prints over and over again. And so Bowman and a friend of his went out deep into the woods to try and find whatever this thing was. And unfortunately they did. I say unfortunately because after several days in the woods, when Bowman was out foraging for food and laying traps to catch animals to, you know, that they could cook and eat, when he got back to the camp, it was all in complete chaos and disarray, and his friend was laying dead on the floor with his neck broken and his throat basically torn apart by savage bites. And it looked like whatever the creature was, it had sort of, almost as Bowman said, it had sort of danced in some manic fashion over the body and sort of, you know, just trampled on it and pulverized it. And Bowman, not surprisingly, was terrified and raced down the mountain, you know, which actually took several days. This is how deep into the forests they were. And he never really went back again to that area. It sort of, you know, chilled him to the bone. And he related this story to Roosevelt, who, as I said, was highly impressed by it. But all the indications from the story are that the creature sounds suspiciously like a violent Bigfoot. Now, fortunately today, we don't get many reports or hardly any reports of actual physical aggressive behavior. There are some reports where these creatures have used intimidation, like throwing rocks and, you know, growling and that sort of thing and banging on trees, but which is often what apes do, interestingly enough. They kind of this bluff bravado where they don't actually attack, but they, you know, scare the whatever out of you anyway.
Sure.
And so, you know, this sounds like it may have been sort of like a Bigfoot gone rogue, if you like. But as I said, the significant thing was, for me at least, it was sort of a great way to start the book with, you know, a story that actually reached the president, and he took it very, very seriously as well.
Now, the government hasn't only investigated these things. Sometimes there have been projects to kind of create these Frankenstein-type monsters. This blew my mind, too.
Yeah, I mean, one of the strangest ones, you know, if we sort of zip from the United States right over to the former Soviet Union, in the 1920s, a Soviet scientist named Ilya Ivanov, he was a brilliant scientist in the field of like animal genetics, but he had this weird obsession, which was to try and create a crossbreed animal, which was sort of half person and half ape. Now, you know, in today's world, that's, if it was ever done, if it ever has been done, you know, secretly or whatever, we would be talking about things like gene splicing, you know, and DNA reconfiguring, that sort of thing. But back in the 1920s, there was nothing like that. But nevertheless, this didn't stop Ivanov pushing ahead with experiments. And he was actually officially funded by the Soviet government's Academy of Sciences to quite a large amount of money, to the extent that he was able to travel to West Africa, where he rounded up a number of gorillas and chimpanzees and brought some of them back to Russia, but also conducted a number of experiments in West Africa itself. And the program was essentially based around trying to impregnate gorillas and female gorillas and female chimpanzees with human sperm, male sperm. And reportedly, at least, or officially, none of the experiments ever worked. They all ended in failure. You know, I mean, our DNA is actually like 98% compatible or identical with a chimpanzee, but it's that 2% that accounts for the many differences. And, you know, nature prevents sort of freaks of nature from appearing for the most part, you know, but nature has a way of, you know, mutating and changing now and again. And there are rumors that one of two of these experiments funded by the Soviet government possibly even worked. And, you know, they gave birth to sort of hideous half-human, half-ape-like creatures that were supposedly banished to the wilds of, like, Siberia. And ironically, then allegedly provoked tales of Soviet Bigfoot on the loose, you know, and people not realizing it was the result of these bizarre experiments. But we're not really sure, you know, of that aspect. The experiments went ahead. There's no doubt about that. Ivanov was a real scientist, although because of all what he did, he ended up in disgrace essentially. But the rumors of the crossbreeds, even at this stage, are still at rumor level more than anything else.
And there's some other interesting things the Soviets were up to I want to talk to you about. This is a mind bender of a book, and we're going to talk about it. Our guest is Nick Redfern. The book is Monster Files, a look inside government secrets and classified documents on bizarre creatures and extraordinary animals. And we'll be right back after this on the Paranormal Podcast. Well, all you have to do is watch TV news or look at online news or read a newspaper. Imagine that. And you'll see that more than ever, your online freedom and privacy are under threat. Now, I told you this 2 months ago, and then all of a sudden all this news broke. But now we know governments and ISPs want to control what you can and can't see while keeping a record of everything you do. So that's one piece of it. But one thing I want to hit on again that we haven't talked about as much the few weeks is this idea that free Wi-Fi at a coffee house or airport can put you at risk too, because your passwords and sensitive data can be intercepted more easily than you might think. So if you're running that unprotected, you're really playing a fool's game. You know, you think you're saving on your data? Think again, because somebody could be intercepting everything you do. There are some nefarious people out there. And you know, going back to the whole controversy about monitoring and so forth, there was a really interesting article on Politico. And it was by Laura Murphy, the director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Washington's legislative office, and Michelle Richardson, who also works for the ACLU. And they said, our surveillance programs are completely out of balance and Congress needs to fix them. Otherwise, the Fourth Amendment will be a mere suggestion. So I got to tell you, it's people on both sides of the aisle that are concerned about all of this monitoring. Is it the right thing for us to do? Well, I can't tell you the right thing for you to do is to check out ProXPN. ProXPN is a global VPN that works with almost any internet connection. It creates a secure, encrypted tunnel through which all of your online data passes back and forth. Now, any online application can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, email, file sharing, and instant messaging programs. It keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location and giving you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. Now, I got to tell you, they're using this heavy-duty encryption, 2048-bit encryption key, and a 512-bit encryption tunnel. But don't let that scare you. That just means your data is safe and secure and private. And if you're like me and you just want it to work, you can turn it on. It's very simple to use. Set it and forget it. Or if you're hardcore and you want to dig down into the settings and things, it's very flexible that way too. I got to tell you, 24/7 customer support. It works with your iOS or Android device. It works with Windows and Mac. You got to try it out. And all you have to do is go over to proxpm.com/paranormal for more information to sign up. Now, again, you get that 7-day free trial. It's a free 7-day risk-free trial for listeners of the Paranormal Podcast. And we do have a special offer. If you use the coupon code PARA, that's PARA, you receive 20% off the lifetime of your account. So you can sign up monthly or yearly. Regardless, it'll be 20% off every time it renews, whether that's every month or every year. So it's really a great deal. Go over and go to proxpn.com/paranormal. That's proxpn.com/paranormal and sign up with the coupon code PARA. It's a very generous offer from our friends over at ProXPN.
Want to help Jim out? Share a show with your friends on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. It's free, and he'll sure appreciate it. Now back to the Paranormal Podcast.
We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Nick Redfern, paranormal 40-year author extraordinaire. The book is Monster Files, a look inside government secrets and classified documents on bizarre creatures and extraordinary animals. Nick, one of the things that interested me is I know that as a result of the Cold War, the United States had a network of listening devices under the sea to monitor for Soviet submarines that carried ballistic missiles. Now, my question is that there was an instance where they picked something up that very well may have been a sea creature. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. There was this this program, which goes back to the 1960s in the U.S. Navy, and they used what are microphones and what are known as hydrophones. It was like a huge underwater array, if you like, which, as you said, was designed to monitor the movements of Soviet submarines, you know, because many of them were armed with nuclear missiles. And the last thing you need, you know, is one of these submarines stealthily creeping up to, like, the Pacific or the Atlantic coastline of the U.S., right. You know. So it was a vital program, and it was known as SOSUS, or the Sound Surveillance System. And at the, you know, at the end of the Cold War, it was sort of scaled down. But the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is known as NOAA, and it's an agency of the government, they had a similar program as well. And collectively, over the years, these programs have tracked not just submarines, but what sound like very, very large unknown animals, which, you know, maybe we could call, some people might refer to them or think they could be like giant squid. Other people suggest sea serpents, or possibly just some sort of monstrous creatures that we haven't identified or classified because they live so deep in the oceans that we never see them. But certainly one of the most famous became known as Bloop, and it was recorded in the summer of 1997, and it was essentially like a signature, if you like, that was recorded for 60 seconds of an amplitude that was detected on sensors for more than 5,000 kilometers from where it actually occurred or where it was tracked. And there were all sorts of different theories within the military and within NOAA as to what it might have been. And some suggestions were that it was a bit of a breakaway of an iceberg. But a number of people who were well-versed in the sort of the sound signatures and the movements of animals felt that Bloop, which was like the nickname given to it, was some sort of gigantic animal. Now, as I said, of what type, we don't know, because the signal appeared, you know, hung around for like a minute or so and then vanished and wasn't repeated, which kind of suggests that it was an animate, real object and possibly, you know, swam back or dove back to the very deepest levels of the ocean. And of course, you know, reports of sea serpents and creatures like this have been reported for thousands of years, you know, never mind hundreds or tens. So, you know, I don't think we can, although in some quarters, as I said, the iceberg theory is believed or concluded, in many quarters it isn't. And so a lot of people do believe that Bloop, whatever it was some sort of, literally like a vast, gigantic animal.
Now, while it's true the government has had a great interest in these things, and that to me lends credence to the existence of them, it has also not been beyond them or beneath them to utilize cryptozoology or possible cryptids for disinformation purposes. Can you talk about some of that activity by various governments out there?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we've sort of gone from the U.S. to Russia and, you know, the oceans. And if we take a trip over to Wales, which is sort of borders England, where I'm originally from, there's a strange story there that goes back to a couple of years before the First World War, which broke out in 1914. So we're talking about 1912, 1913. And there's a lake in North Wales called Lake Bala, B-A-L-A. And when it was obvious or clear to the government, the British government of the day, that war was going to break out with Germany, the British Royal Navy had this secret plan to try and train SEALs to attack German battleships out in the English Channel and the North Sea. The idea was to sort of strap dynamite and explosive to the SEALs and train them to charge towards the ships, the German ships, and then have the explosive detonate, you know, as the SEALs literally closed in on them. And of course, the idea was that the Germans would be looking for British battleships, etc. They wouldn't be looking for SEALs, and even if they saw them, they wouldn't take notice of them. And so what the Navy did was they set up this secret project in Lake Bala where they had handlers and trainers who tried to train the SEALs, you know, where they'd have like just dummy pieces of wood strapped to their backs,
right,
and they'd try and teach them to sort of charge little rowing boats, that kind of thing. It was sort of seen as a local ideal place to do it because there were just, you know, a few local little villages and word wasn't going to get out. Now, over time, it turned out that, you know, the SEALs weren't really that easy to train. And whether astutely realizing or not, they didn't seem keen about having even dummy mines or explosives attached to them.
Smart SEALs.
And eventually they stopped responding to the handlers and just sort of lived wild and happily in the lake. Now, because this was a military program, and word actually did start to get around in the area that, well, the military are up to something, you know, in the dead of night, they're sort of, they've got flashlights and they've, you know, there's these animals zipping around the water, something was going on. And so the military sort of bid a hasty retreat and let the SEALs stay there. You know, there's no way they could round them up. But what they did was to spread rumors that there were lake monsters in Lake Bala, you know, something like the Loch Ness Monster, if you like,
right,
even though that wasn't sort of well known at the time, but, you know, like sea serpent type things, because they realized that people locally had got, you know, the word had got out something mysterious was going on, and because they were worried that if the real story got out, it would reach the Germans and they might try something similar, they camouflaged it all under these rumors, oh, it's sea serpents or it's lake monsters. And, you know, half the people believed them and half the people ridiculed it. So either way, it acted as a good cover for the real story. So in other words, this demonstrates how stories of monsters have actually been created by military agencies to act as a cover for something else.
Yeah, it fascinates me the different ways that things can be, information can be manipulated to deceive an enemy. And that's not always, you know, we always associate that with negative or things. But for example, yeah, in the Second World War, that's great. If there's a way to outsmart the Germans, that's fantastic, you know.
Well, so right. I mean, one of the most important things about a lot of these disinformation programs is they worked by deceiving the enemy and preventing them from, you know, taking interest in this area or attacking this location. And very often they were done without having to actually send troops in. So in other words, you know, a lot of these programs actually saved lives because they worked at a psychological level to where, you know, they had the Germans or whoever going down a different avenue or chasing their own tails. And, you know, the troops, in some cases at least, weren't forced to go on the battlefield because the Germans had left the area the Japanese or whoever because of this particular program, you know.
Yeah, if you're interested in military history out there, check out Google Patton's Ghost Army. Fascinating stuff. Absolutely fascinating stuff. Now, you have a chapter here. I love this. In search of the government's mermaids. In search of the government's mermaids. Tell us about that. That's just so great of a title. I can't help but ask about that one.
Well, yeah, the reason I include this is because back in 2012, just over a year ago, the Animal Planet broadcast a show called Mermaids, The Body Found. And actually, since publication of the book just a few weeks ago, they broadcast a follow-up show. Both of them were extremely well done, and they dealt with the issue of supposedly government agencies having secret knowledge that there was like an ancient humanoid race of humans that millions of years ago went into the oceans and started to develop more like fish than people. You know, over millions of years, lungs became gills, the fingers became webbed, etc. Now, unfortunately, we're not talking about sort of hot-looking mermaids like Daryl Hannah in Splash, unfortunately. They're actually, the way the shows described them, they were more like the creature from the Black Lagoon. They were sort of like gruesome fish people or something like that. Now, this is actually a theory that's existed within cryptozoology for many years. It's known as the aquatic ape theory. The idea that millions of years ago, you know, there was a divergence of the early types of human, and some of them went onto land and some of them, you know, stayed in the water and developed along these lines. And the two Animal Planet shows suggested that there was this big cover-up because the government was frightened to tell the people that there were these savage sort of subhuman fish people, you know, living under the oceans. What a lot of people didn't realize and got quite angry about was that the shows were both spoofs. You know, they were very well done. The special effects were very good. And the actors, you know, portrayed people in the U.S. government who were supposedly working on these classified programs to hide the truth from the general public. But then when the truth came out, you know, a lot of people felt cheated, etc. But what was most interesting is, and this is why I included this in the book, was because just after the show was broadcast, the real-life equivalent of the agency that was portrayed in the show, which was the National Ocean Service, which is a branch of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is a major arm of the U.S. government, they actually put out a big statement on their website saying that essentially there's no evidence that the U.S. government has ever found evidence to support the notion that mermaids really exist. Now, some conspiracy theorists said it was almost like the government was protesting too much. Yeah, because, you know, I mean, you think of it. This is an official government website of a major official body, the National Ocean Service, and they opened or created a page saying, honestly, you know, we haven't found any evidence of mermaids. And a number of other conspiracy theorists wondered if, ironically, the Animal Planet show, even though it was fiction presented as like in faction, if you like, if they'd actually inadvertently stumbled upon a real secret of, you know, some sort of underwater fish-like people, you know, fish-human-like creatures living under the oceans, and that, as I said, that it was a case of protesting too much, you know. We'll never really know, I guess, but it certainly prompted a lot of debate in conspiracy circles, which is, you know, why I mentioned it in the book.
Tell us one of your favorite chapters or stories from the book as we kind of wind down here. There's so much in this book. Folks have got to check it out. I mean, if you're into cryptozoology or conspiracy, or even better yet, both, this is a must read. But what's one of your favorites? Something that even stuns the very seasoned and, I guess, grizzled veteran of for all things Fortiana, Nick Redfern. What blows your mind in this book?
Well, I mean, one of the fascinating ones for me was the story of Mount St. Helens in Washington State, I'm sure a lot of people remember who were around at the time, how in May 1980 there was this massive volcanic explosion which sent volcanic ash thousands of feet or tens of thousands of feet into the air and flattened hundreds of square miles surrounding Washington State and actually killed more than 60 people who refused to leave their homes. And estimates were that somewhere in the region more than 1,000 elk were killed and, you know, just tens of thousands of smaller other animals as well. And at the time, you know, the military went in to try and offer as much help as possible and, you know, airlift people out the area and also help tend and help recover some of the injured animals, you know, because veterinarians were on standby as well. And ever since, almost literally within weeks of Mount St. Helens exploding, there have been rumors within cryptozoological circles that the military, when they went and found, you know, a lot of these elk bodies and wolves, etc., stumbled upon a number of badly burned, dead, and even supposedly injured but alive Bigfoot. And a number of military people have come forward. Now, as I point out in the book, granted, they've all come forward anonymously, you know, so we can never really be sure of the veracity of the stories. But when you consider how many stories there are and spread across now, which is 33 years since the event occurred, you know, we've got a substantial body of material. And collectively, you know, they talk about the military flying in with sort of large double-rotor Chinook helicopters and airlifting these bodies out in powerful nets, etc. For where they were sent to, we don't know, but there are rumors about military autopsies of the bodies, etc., and trying to determine what they were. But the weird thing is, you know, why this would be kept secret if, you know, sure, if Bigfoot's just an unknown ape, why not reveal it as a major zoological discovery? That's one of the things that's kind of odd about the military's relationship, if you like, to Bigfoot. We do find a lot of stories and tales of secret investigations of Bigfoot in the US, but again, it's sort of baffling as to why they would be secret. You know, it wouldn't be like an investigation of a grizzly bear wouldn't be secret. You know, there'd be no point. So why Bigfoot? Unless there's something weirder about Bigfoot. And of course, you know, we, as I point out in the book, government agencies have at times taken an interest in cases where Bigfoot has been seen at the same time and the same location as UFO activity. So that's given rise to the theory that, you know, is Bigfoot linked with UFOs, or is it linked with sort of like dimensional gateways and portals, that kind of thing? And so that opens a lot of, you know, controversial areas, if you like.
I have to ask you this because it amazes me, because you delve into so many different areas of the paranormal, Fortiana, that kind of things. And I, on a much lighter level, delve as well. I've been doing it for 8 years, but you know, I kind of look at it as you're a player on the field of sport, and I'm a sports reporter. That's kind of the way I look at it. I talk to the newsmakers and I talk to the experts. So, but for me, I know the more I talk about these things and the more people I talk to, sometimes it doesn't necessarily provide clarity, but it's almost like being Alice in Wonderland and going down the rabbit hole and just kind of like, oh, there's that connection, and there's this connection. You know, it just seems an ever-increasing web of intermingled strangeness. I mean, do you get clarity as you go along, or does it get weirder the longer you do this?
Well, you know, I mean, that's actually a good question. I mean, where we do have clarity, you know, I always say, but it's like with the, you know, the Mount St. Helens thing, as I pointed out, a lot of the stories are from whistleblowers, and, you know, and I don't shy away from telling people what we know versus what certain people who remain unnamed allege, which is two very different things, you know what I mean? And so I always feel it's important, and the responsible thing is to stress, you know, this is what we can prove, this is what we've heard, this is what appears in the official documents, which have been officially declassified, and this is what's at rumor level. And as long as we can kind of understand and grasp the differences, then for me that's okay. You know, what I don't do and what I don't like is when researchers come to a conclusion when it's based more on belief rather than, you know, on hard facts. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit sometimes we don't have hard facts and we are sort of left sometimes more puzzled than when we began, you know, but that's just one of the hazards. Hopefully, you know, we sort of, you know, hit the target more times than we're sort of in the gray area, so to speak.
Well, this is a man who always hits the target, and he has it with this book, Monster Files, A Look Inside Government Secrets and Classified Documents on Bizarre Creatures and Extraordinary Animals. Our guest has been Nick Redfern. Where can folks, Nick, go on the web, and where can they go to pick up the book and learn everything that you're doing?
Well, people can reach me, find out what I'm doing at my blog, which is nickredfern14, F-O-R-T-E-A-N, nickredfern14.blogspot.com. And I try and update that daily with everything from UFOs, cryptozoology, strange phenomena, lectures I'm doing, etc. And people can buy the book, Monster Files. It's published by New Page Books. They can get it on all good online sites like Amazon, and you can buy it off the shelves in Barnes & Noble as well.
Very good. Nick Redfern, thank you so much for joining us tonight on the Paranormal Podcast.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim.
And thank you for tuning in to the Paranormal Podcast. We appreciate it as always, as most people find out about us from iTunes. If you are an iTunes type of person, please go over there and give us a review and hopefully a 4 or 5 star review. I know we've been getting a lot of nice reviews lately and I'm very appreciative of it. And that's how folks find us. We kind of rise to the top as people see us on iTunes. So we certainly appreciate that. And we appreciate you for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com and thanks for listening.